On the thumb of one hand, the American who is at once a comedian, a humorist, a wit, and a satirist. And his name is Fred Allen. James Thurber wrote that about Fred Allen some time ago. Came as kind of a shock to us to discover that there were young ladies, right, working in our offices who did not know who Fred Allen was. Well, today, on today, we want to visit with the people who remember Fred Allen very, very well because they worked for him and with him. Fred Allen was not only a very great wit, he was a great man. We want to demonstrate that this morning. Listen to these quotes. Every spring on the sixth floor, the vice presidents come up carpet to spawn. In California, they should hang the people on trees and give the oranges the vote. They call television a medium because nothing on it is well done. All three of these jokes are unmistakably Fred Allen jokes. No one else could have written them. And yet all his life, Fred Allen refused to think of himself as a writer. He was a comedian, and prior to that, he had been a juggler. Just to get ourselves oriented, however, we want to show you a few pictures that are from his book, Much Ado About Me. These are the early years of Fred Allen, or John Florence Sullivan, as he was known in his non-pro days in Boston. Brother Bob Sullivan, on the right there. James Henry Sullivan, a Boston bookbinder, and his two young sons, we see here. Mrs. Sullivan died of pneumonia when the older boy was three. The fourth lad from the left on this 1910 basketball team is 16-year-old John Sullivan. Freddie James, an early pseudonym for a show business tyro, the world's worst juggler. We get applause on any bill. And Fred Allen, a young fellow trying to get along. Ben Franklin, that's another pseudonym. This time so that he could get out of a contract with the Schuberts, the theater dynasty. A juggler in a top hat. And as Allen identifies this, a study in elegance. And this is the Fred Allen most of us remember as he described himself, a man with poached eyes. How Freddie James, the world's worst juggler, became Fred Allen, the world's most quotable comedian, is a case with many expert witnesses, and we're going to be talking to some of those witnesses in just 2 minutes. Right now, this is Today on NBC. When Fred Allen was a bright, fresh young man out of Boston trying to make it in New York, one of the people that he met, the first ones he met, was James Harkins, a vaudevillian of some standing. Uncle Jim, as the gentleman is known to everybody in radio and television now, wound up as one of Fred's closest friends and, I'd say, chief dispenser of the Allen Charity Funds, is what you now are. Is that not correct, sir?
Well, Fred, of course, gave a lot of money away himself. And then in other cases, he'd say, Jim, I hear Johnny Cantwell's in the hospital. Will you go over and take a look? You know, and stuff like that.
Clarify that.
Yes, I'd go over there, and when I went over to see Johnny, his wife come in, and she says, look, John, look, a letter from Fred, a letter from Fred. Check for $500 in there. You know, these are old-timers who in their day were dapper, clever fellas, you know.
What about the old times now for Fred himself? When you first met him, was he witty?
Witty as a kid. I first met him around 1913. And I was in vaudeville then, doing very well. And he would come around 46th Street. That was our hangout, the NBA club, see? Mm-hmm. And sit out on the steps in nice weather. And we liked this kid because he was so far ahead of us old-timers in creative humor. Creative wit.
Did his act consist of humor then? Or
yes. He was doing juggling with cracks, you know, funny sayings. But the sayings were too smart for the time. And he would get canned in almost every house he worked in.
Because he really was ahead of his time.
He was ahead of his time, and which calls to mind one time he come down the street, and I says, oh, don't tell me, that's again, kid. He says, yes, got it again. Well, I says, now look, why don't you try this, Fred? I'll give you three or four old tried and true gags, you know, Boppo's old surefire hokum gags, and you deal them off the plate in between your clever stuff, and that way you'll entertain some of the, you'll let them in on the stuff. Well, he says, thanks ever so much, Jim, but I'm going to stick to this line until I succeed. There must be some intelligent people somewhere in this world, and I'm going to keep looking after them. And that's what he did. He wouldn't stoop to hokum as we knew it, you know? He always stayed up on that plane that made him always an outstanding creator of humor of anybody in the business.
And he called himself the world's worst juggler. Was he a bad juggler?
Well, he wasn't a bad juggler, but he would miss tricks, you know, to make it look bad, so to emphasize a gag. He was playing he could rise to the occasion any time he was playing Los Gates in Brooklyn. It was a supper show, and there were only 150 people in that big theater. And he's doing his act, he's down front. All of a sudden, two people got up here and walked out of the theater. He kept on doing it, reaching for these things and the cigar box tricks and stuff. After a while, two people got up on that side and got up. He didn't pay any attention, but when two got up in the center and walked up the aisle, he stepped to the footlights and he says, ladies and gentlemen, they must have moved Noah's Ark up to the front of this theater. People are leaving in pairs. You know, he could take these Bible things and fit them, you know, right into the where they belong, you know.
Yeah, that is it.
That was the type of Fred all the time. He never. And then we went to Australia, of course. We were playing there, my wife and I, in 1915, and Fred was in Australia.
Did he go to Australia?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In 15. We never saw each other in Australia, although we corresponded, see? Mm-hmm. He was playing the Cairns over there, and we were playing the good theaters. I don't say that egotistically, but this was the time, see?
Right.
And he laid an egg over there just as big as he did here, see? Or bombed, if you want to say it, yes. And Australia had a habit that when they booked you from here, they paid your fare from San Francisco to Sydney, with stopovers at Hawaii, the Fijis, you know, and so New Zealand and Sydney. And then they paid your fare Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, and around. But if you didn't make good, they would hope you would get disgusted and want to come right back, see, because you had a pay-or-play contract, see? And everybody would, you know, say after they flopped a couple of shows, they'd say, I want to get out of this lousy country. Where's this skyscraper? Where's your subway? You know, to try to find something wrong with the place. And, of course, they'd gladly give them their tickets back, but not Fred. When he bombed, they started to give him what they call the ozone route. That's the travel route that will get you disgusted. So they come back to him and say, in Melbourne, say, Mr. James, yes, your next engagement will be at Christchurch, New Zealand. See? He says, thank you, thank you. Now, they'd pay us fare, but he had to lay off a week to get the boat, and then the time the boat got into New Zealand, he had another week off before he opened, see? And it was short dough. So the time when he opened, then they'd say, Mr. James, your next engagement is Perth, Australia. And that's gone through the same thing. As I say, the average fellow would give up. Not Alan. He went through all of these things and took them all in stride. And finally, to finish, they ran out of excuses. But he was so nice about it, they didn't know what to do. And if there's anything the Australians love, it's a guy with guts, with courage. And Mr. He had it. So at his last stop, they said, you go in and see Sir Wilbur, you know, the head of the circuit in Sydney for your next engagement. He says, right. Now, he knows when he's going to go and see this big man that something's going to happen. So he stops at an Army and Navy store, buys himself a Navy suit, a sailor's hat, goes up to the office. The clerk says, yes. He says, I want to see Sir so-and-so. He says, I'm Freddie James. Oh, he says, just a minute. Walks in. The man says, send him in. He's waiting for an American to come in to tell him off. So that Fred walked in, he says, hi, matey, where do we go from here? You know. So the man got up, put his arm around Fred, he says, God blimey, he says, you're the gamest fellow I ever knew in my life, and you can stay here for the rest of your life. We admire such pluck and gut. And Fred could have stayed there. In fact, for years after that, he corresponded with him over there, stage door men, everybody. But that kind of stick-to-itiveness.
He was always a nice guy, good to get along with and generous.
He wasn't the life of the party guy or anything like that. Didn't put the dame's hat on, you know, or nothing, see?
Yeah.
But when it came to entertaining,
he really created.
Yep.
Where'd he get the name Alan? I mean, how'd that...
Well, that was through an agent here, Edgar Allan. You see, he started in so his aunt wouldn't know he was an amateur knight and stuff as Paul Huckle. That is, he cut Huckleberry in half and called himself Paul Huckle, see?
Yeah.
Then he kept that for a while. And then when He got to playing around these cans around New York. This agent told him, says, you'll have to change your name on that because it's opposition to the Keith houses. This was the Keeney Circuit. And if you played the Keeney turn, you couldn't play for Keith or Orpheum. And all the acts would change their names, see? So he says, well, all right, I'll take your name, you know.
And Fred Allen. Fred Allen.
And that's how he comes in.
And, of course, none of you back in those days foresaw anything like broadcasting.
No. Broadcasting was ridiculous to us, you know.
Yeah.
We laughed at it. I remember John Barrymore saying one time at the Waldorf Astoria, when they said, would you do that soliloquy from Hamlet? He says, I'll do it, but not in that inverted cuspidor.
Referring to the microphone?
Yes.
That's
cool. Oh, sure.
Yeah, the times do change. He really made an adaptation to that. And of course, radio was where he made the big...
Naturally. But nobody worked harder than this fellow.
He wrote day and night. We're visiting with James Harkins, who's maybe closer to Uncle Jim. That's what
I was. You say James, I start looking around.
Uncle Jim Harkins.
I thought I was Max Asness for a minute there.
We'll have Max Asness on a little later on. We have to take a station break now, though. We'll be back.
I am Keith and Nancy Malone star Thursday at 10, 9 Central Time.
Look to Jack Latham and other featured KNBC newsmen for the top news stories of each day, the local and national scene, at 6 o'clock every Monday through Friday.
Call today. This day is Wednesday. It's the 18th of March, 1964, and we are saluting one of the great, great men of radio and stage, of course, and television, too, I guess I could add. Movies also. Fred Allen.
Yeah, the whole program devoted to Fred Allen's memory. He passed away 8 years ago this week. It's amazing. Somehow it doesn't seem that long. We've been reminiscing with Uncle Jim Harkins. We have some friends.
It was the first time I met Uncle Jim and Fred. We were cutting a series of transcriptions. There were little one-minute cuts advertising the fact that Fred was coming back on the air. And I walked into the studio, and I was playing with Fred. And, of course, I was a brash young fella from the coast. And I didn't care who I ad-libbed with, and I threw an ad-lib crack at Fred in the middle of a script. And his opening remark was, well, White Fang. Then he went on from there.
You know, one day at rehearsal, we were rehearsing on the third floor up here. After rehearsal, we come out, Fred and I, and we got near the steps that used to lead down the second floor. He's going to go around the elevator, and he says, Jim, I think I left a script on the control room. Would you go back and get it? I'll wait here. Why? I said, sure. I went back, got the script. When he come out, there was a young fellow just come east, and he was full of, you know, the old stuff. He's going to show him this is his chance. He grabbed Fred. And he's talking to Fred, and you could always tell when Fred was annoyed with these guys. He had straightened up and he got so dignified, you know. When I got up, I knew there was trouble. And when I got up there, the fellow says, look, I'm not trying to sell you gags. I'm giving you gags for Claghorn, Titus Moody, Nussbaum, and Cassidy. I'm giving it. Fred sees me, looks at him, and he says, giving me gags is like giving Henry Ford a Fender. Ford was our sponsor at the time.
We're going to stroll down Allen's Alley with Jack Lasculli and people who actually did the Allen's Alley in the Fred Allen radio days, and we'll get to those things. You'll be meeting all of them there.
Here they are.
Yes, indeed.
Kenny Delmar.
Sure.
In the middle.
Parker Finley.
And, of course, Peter Donald.
Peter Donald, whom you'll remember as, respectively, Senator Claghorn, Titus Moody, and Ajax Cassidy. And we'll start with the news, though.
Good morning. The United States delivered a strong warning. Hugh Downs and Today. memorable television event. A new production of Little Moon of Alban, starring Julie Harris, recreating the role of Bridget Mary, and Dirk Bogarde, making his American TV drama debut as an English officer. Little Moon of Alban, winner of 12 major TV awards when first presented, is a poignant story of a girl whose life is suddenly destroyed by the Irish Rebellion. In grief, she clings to her faith and becomes a nursing nun.
Grace, the Lord is with thee.
Then her cloistered world is shattered when she is sent to care for a wounded enemy officer. The Hallmark Hall of Fame presents Julie Harris and Dirk Bogarde in George Schaefer's color production of Little Moon of Alban, James Costigan's award-winning drama, Wednesday at 7:30, 6:30 Central Time on NBC.
If you don't remember Fred Allen, whom we're saluting today, we're supplying some of the reasons that you should. We're passing some of the people standing outside on 49th Street now, who, as usual, are peering in at us. But one of the greatest things about Fred Allen, and those of you who do remember him, recall Allen's Alley, that every night that they were on, he and his wife, Portland, would stroll down the alley and visit in order to talk over some of the current events and topics with inhabitants of this alley. And among the alley's inhabitants were a blowhard Southern senator, you'll remember, Senator Claghorn, a windy Irishman named Ajax Cassidy, and a taciturn New Englander named Titus Moody. With all due apologies to the great Fred Allen, Jack LaSchooley will take a stroll down Allen's Alley now in memory to chat with the occupants, recreating some of the most memorable moments in Allen's Alley, which was once a compulsory ritual for Sunday radio fans.
Ah, what a night in Allen's Alley. I guess I ought to see what Senator Claghorn is up to.
Somebody, I see somebody wham the watches.
Yes,
Claghorn's name, Senator Claghorn, that is.
Look,
make
Senator.
It snappy, son. I got to hightail it. I got to shake my pegs. I'm taking it on the old Tant Tibby.
You're leaving town.
I'm the guest of honor at Carnegie Hall, son. The Mobile Philharmonic is giving a concert. The Mobile Philharmonic is the finest musical aggregation in the South.
A big band?
400 men. The leader is Arturo Tuscaloosa. Instead of a baton, Arturo conducts with a hoe handle.
Oh, it must be some outfit.
Why, it's the only band in the world with a hound dog choir. Son, when the Mobile Philharmonic does the barcarolle, you can hear the barking 20 miles away.
You can. How is the woodwind section?
Now, I never seen so much wood and heard so much wind.
And the string section?
Well, they got the rope, hemp, and twine. That's string aplenty.
And the brass.
Yep, they carry 30 spittoons. More brass than that is showing off.
Now, what numbers does the Mobile Philharmonic play?
All the classics, son. Everything by Rimsky-Culpepper. The Georgia Cracker Suite, The Flight of the Boll Weevil, Poet and Sharecropper, Moonshine Sonata, Rhapsody in Gray, and, of course, no concert is complete without the Claghorn Fifth.
You wrote it, Senator?
I drink it. Yeah. I'm too fast for you, son. Admit it. You ain't got it upstairs. Or downstairs, neither.
Well, the Senator is in his usual good spirits. Let's look in on Titus Moody.
Howdy, bub.
You look wide awake, Mr. Moody. What have you been doing?
Oh, I've been to the circus.
Tell me, mister, what feature of the circus did you like best?
Oh, shucks. The circus don't mean nothing to me. My whole family was circus folks.
Really?
Yeah. They was freaks, mostly. My uncle, Geek Moody, he was known as Jojo the Dog-Faced Boy. He used to pose for dog food ads.
Oh, I've heard of Jojo.
And I had a cousin, Choice Moody. Choice was a fire eater. He called himself Dr. Blaze.
I see.
One night, Dr. Blaze had a touch of indigestion. He hiccuped three bonfires and set fire to a small group of friends.
Oh, gosh.
And I had another cousin, Lacey Moody. He went under the name of Elasto the Rubber Man.
A real rubber man?
Yeah. Elasto, he could shake hands with you, and while you were still holding his hand, he'd go into the next room and start taking off his things. You could either walk into the next room with the lasso's hand, or you could let go and the hand would snap back through the door and back up a lasso sleeve.
Now, Titus, what became of Alasto?
Oh, he took sick in Duluth. They started to take out his appendix.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor made the incision.
And Alasto, the rubber man?
Died of a slow leak.
And that brings us to Mr. Cassidy, Shanty. I wonder what's happening at the Shea Cassidy tonight.
Here's that old elephant fan. How do you do?
I see now.
Well, how are you?
How are you tonight, Mr. Cassidy?
Oh, I'm terrible, me boy. Oh, me right leg is so heavy I can't lift it up.
Your right leg is heavy?
Yeah, it's full of iron. Pig iron.
Oh, now that's silly. How could your system get full of pig iron?
I've been eating too many pork chops, I think. I'm not long for this world.
Mr. Cassidy, what is that ladder you have there?
Oh, I'm going over to Sweeney's for dinner.
And you have to carry a ladder?
Uh-huh. See, the dining room table is too high. You can't sit on chairs. Everybody sits on ladders.
And why is that? Is the dining room table so high?
Well, Sweeney's a mounted cop, you see, and he always rides into dinner on his horse.
Oh, I see.
Sweeney never uses a napkin, neither. He wipes his hands on the back of his horse. There is so much food on the back of Sweeney's horse, he has mice under his saddle.
Mice under his saddle. Fine. Well, tell me, Mr. Cassidy, what about this used car dealer business?
Oh, that. Well, now, me boy, we're living in an age of high pressure. People are hounded into buying cars with them slogans. You know, there's a Ford in your future.
I see.
Yeah. Well, where I'm going in the future, a Ford won't help. What I'll need is a fire engine with an asbestos hose, too.
I see.
And how about the Pontiac is the most beautiful thing on wheels?
Now, what's wrong with that?
The most beautiful thing on wheels is Maureen O'Hara on a bicycle.
I can see your point.
And how about ask the man who owns one?
Now, that's Packard.
Yes. Have you ever tried to talk to a man in a Packard?
No.
Ask the man who owns one. He won't even answer you.
Tell me, did you ever use an automobile?
Well, now, me boy, after many years of contemplation, due deliberation, during which I have studied the various means of transportation and weighed their merits pro and con, I have arrived at one conclusion.
And what is your conclusion?
That it is best for me to restrict me travel to one type of vehicle.
And that is?
The station wagon.
The station wagon?
Sure. Every Saturday night when they take me away to the station?
Yes.
They send the wagon. Goodbye to you, boy.
Now, here's you.
That was a bit of nostalgia there. Allen's Alley, the Sterling citizens populating Allen's Alley. As you remember, Kenny Delmar as Senator Claghorn, Parker Fennelly as Titus Moody, and Peter Donald as Ajax Cassidy. We're going to hear more from them and more about Fred Allen in this two-hour salute a little later on. Right now, about what would the time be? 47 minutes after the hour, I think. And on this commercial, I should give you the right time, actually. But what I'm going to talk about can give you the right time. There we are. Reminiscing about Fred Allen, we are in a few seconds going to be talking with the people who were Allen's Alley. Kenny Delmar, Parker Fennelly, and Peter Donald. Jack and I will be chatting with them. Let's take a station break right now. The thing most people remember about Fred Allen, I think, was his wit. And one of the things I remember most was his appraisal of vice presidents. Do you remember, Jack, that he said, a vice president is a crew-cut young man from Dartmouth who arrives at his desk every morning at 9 o'clock and finds a molehill there. He then has until 5 o'clock to make a mountain of it.
That was Fred's. Or there was another one, and I quote him, you can take all the sincerity in Hollywood and conceal it in a flea's navel and still have room left over for 6 caraway seeds in an agent's heart. That line appeared in a letter to Kenny Delmar, who played Senator Claghorn on Fred's radio show. Kenny is with us to help salute the master. So is Parker Fennelly, who played Titus Moody, and of course Peter Donald, who played Ajax Cassidy. Gentlemen, a general question. We'll start with you, Kenny. What was Fred like to work with?
Fred was the most calm, efficient, and easy man to work with that I've ever worked with. His shows were a pleasure from the rehearsal day to the final broadcast.
How did he treat you, Parker, in rehearsals?
Oh, just the same. He treated me wonderfully. I said once before when we were being interviewed, I think, that I always felt that big things didn't bother Fred. If they did, he didn't show it. But sometimes little trivial things, for instance, we used to be working in 3C, I guess it was, and the tourists going through the building used to sometimes open the door and look in. And this angered Fred very much. And he always used to call out to them, "How would you like it if we peeked out at you?"
Peters, do you agree with all this?
No, it was a little thing I'll never forget. The boys know this. One day, he came in. Now, as Uncle Jim said, Fred was one of the most generous men in the world. And to back up Jim about the little people he did good things for, I remember that unfortunate day, his funeral. And it was a snowy day, being this time of the year. And we were there, of course, and Herb Schreiner came and Jack Haley flew from the coast. But not many of the big names made it. And the whole church was full of these little, weazened, formerly talented people. And they were the people that he had honestly kept alive. But he gave out all that money. But on his way down to the studio, he used to pass a fruit stand. And there would be a man there, and he sold apples and pears. And they were 10 cents a piece for the apples, or 3 for a quarter. So Fred took 2 apples and 1 pear, and the guy said that broke up a match set. That didn't work, and it spoiled Fred's day, you know. For one nickel, it spoiled his day. No, he said, if there's 3, it doesn't matter whether there's 2 of one and 1 the other. But the other man had a policy, you know, and I remember quite it. It's Paul Fred's whole afternoon.
He did the same thing about tobacco. He had a place that he used to go to all the time for tobacco. And they raised the price, the import price or something on it. And he said to the man, "Well, I don't think this is not a reasonable price. I've been buying this tobacco for so many years." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, that's the price." And so Fred stopped smoking.
Gave it up.
I'll tell you, the line up, and the boys will agree at the theater, and it was a long line. And Fred always had a whole group of brand new $1 bills in his pocket, and they would wait for him. And when he came up with Portland, why, he would go down the line and pass it to them. So I asked Uncle Jim one night backstage, I said, "Are all these people, I hear them say, you know, 'Hi, Fred, remember me? I played with you at the Lyceum Theater. I played with you at this theater, and now I'm in the Circle Theater.'" And he'd go down the line and give each one of them a little money. And this was every single week that he was on the air. So one day I asked Jim, I said, "Are all these people, were they all in vaudeville with him?" He says, "Jack, if all these people were in vaudeville with him," he says, "vaudeville would still be going strong."
But he had the ones in one pocket, but as Jim will confirm, in another pocket he had 5s.
Yes.
And after many years, I asked Fred, we'd come out of one of the exits here at NBC, and I said, "Fred, they always get you, don't they?" And he said, "Well, it's all right." But I said, "I notice you have 5 in one pocket and 1 in the other." He said, "Well, the 5s are for those guys that need it more."
Oh, it's cheap.
I was wondering if he ad-libbed much. The show was prepared, but did he ad-lib when we were on the air?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
And he didn't mind when we did, too. If we could break him, he loved it.
Yeah.
If we could break him up.
Well, did he ad-lib in rehearsals pretty much the same as on the air, or different?
No, it was different. No, you never knew what was coming.
Yeah.
And once he broke me up in the opening announcement because he made faces at me across the microphone, and I just broke up the whole, you know, how the fanfare is. The Fred Allen Show with the DeMarco, and I'm doing all this, and he's going, making a face at me. So it broke me up. And I don't know whether he liked the ad-lib or not. I think he did because he had a wonderfully generous nature and everything. And I didn't know what else to say except that I was thinking about the Jack Benny program.
That must have taken care of things.
I tell you, just corollary to what Kenny said to begin with about Fred, these rehearsals were calm and organized, and we probably only rehearsed about 4 hours and then a dress rehearsal, and boom, that was it.
Yeah.
But I had the pleasure of working on the rewrite staff for the last 5 years. I did it for nothing, just for the pleasure of working with Fred. And I've often said that just for those hours that we spent upstairs on the
on the, probably the sixth floor or the seventh floor in the writing room. I said it probably put 10 years on my age and my life. I mean, gave me 10 years, which I would love to have given back to him. But he said once that he thought that the ideal guest shot, the guest stars, and you know he had the pick of them all, he said would be Roland Young and Monty Woolley. And this kind of bugged us a little bit. He said, what's that? Well, because as he pointed out,
Monty Woolley talked this way.
And he said, we could use the same script for the whole 39 weeks. You'd never know what they would say. That's a good idea.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, some people have said that Fred Allen is a cynic, analyzing his writings and everything. Was he cynical, or did he enjoy life? What would you say? Parker, do you want to tackle that?
I don't know. He did give that impression sometimes, but he had the softest heart of anybody I know.
So he could have been completely cynical.
I wouldn't think he could be completely.
I think he could cross it and say he enjoyed being cynical.
Maybe that was it.
Yeah. Well, cynical thing, I think the story that was told about him was the story where a newsboy stepped off the curb into the street, and Fred yanked him out of the way just as a truck came by, and the truck almost hit the boy, and he yanked him back up on the curb, and he says, what's the matter, kid? He says, don't you want to grow up and have troubles?
Yeah, of course, he never went to nightclubs. I think my wife and I were the only ones that got him to go to El Morocco. And the next week we had Boye on. He had him as the doorman of El Morocco. But, I mean, Fred didn't care much for the nightlife kind of things. He had his books. He loved reading. He read all the time.
He made one appearance at the old Club 18. And I understand walked in, and they took him apart like they did with everybody. That was an insult club. And then Fred came up. And they tell me that the speech he made that night devastated Jack White, Joe Frisco, Jackie Gleason, and everybody else.
That would be hard to do.
He could do it. We're visiting, and we have less than half a minute remaining. And we want to give our thanks at this time, even though they'll be with us throughout the morning, to our three guests who are from Allen's Alley, who worked with Fred Allen very, very closely. Kenny Delmar, who was the announcer, and Senator Claghorn, most famous, and Parker Finley and Peter Donald. And the countdown is at hand. We'll take a station break and return for many of you. This is today, Wednesday, March 18th, and a good time to remember the treasures of a very great man, Fred Allen.
Fred Allen died just 8 years ago this week, and Fred left behind the greatest collection of wit, I guess, of any American comedian.
True. And we're with the people throughout this morning on our program who worked with him and who knew him well, and we'll be getting to those things, talking with these people right after we start, as usual, with the news. A poll taker is a man who can look in the bottom of a birdcage and then tell you how many grains of sand there are in the Sahara. Advertising is 85% perspiration and 15% commission. And a couple of Fred Allen lines. We're devoting the morning to the revisiting of the days of Fred Allen. Morning, and we have some of his friends with us throughout the morning and co-workers. We ask one of his great friends and about once a year a co-worker about a celebrated feud.
Ladies and gentlemen, contrary to the feud that Fred Allen and I had for so many years, we were, of course, the best of friends. In fact, we would have had to be very close friends to carry on a feud that long and that vitriolic. And it could only have been accomplished with a comedian as talented as Fred, and the fact that he was a good editor and a perfectionist. He also had, when it came to comedy, had a great sense of exaggeration. I'll never forget one line he pulled about me. As he said, Jack Benny isn't really stingy. It's just that he has short arms and carries his money low in his pockets. Now, who else would think of a thing like that? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Fred Allen was one of our great, great humorists. And like Will Rogers, has never been replaced.
Yes, indeed. Another of Fred's closest friends was Uncle Jim Harkins, a vaudeville headliner who kind of helped Fred get started. Fred was a struggling young juggler then. And we're talking with Uncle Jim this morning, too. In 1934, Uncle Jim went to work as Fred's strong right arm. And you were with him right up to the last.
His death, yes.
And it was 8 years ago, 8 years and one day.
17th of March.
Yeah.
The night of 17th
of March, 1956. Yeah. Jack and I want to just talk to you again a little bit, Uncle Jim, about how'd you happen to make the connection with Fred connect with him?
There was two angles to that. I was doing an amateur hour on WMCA, Herbert's Blue White Diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was from 1 to 2. And I was running a marathon dance at the same time up in Derby, Connecticut. I had a skeleton in that thing, you know.
This was in 34.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred used to listen to this thing every Sunday. And the agency was talking about this new idea. Major Bowes had, you know, got a lot of notoriety from WHN on this thing. And this agency wanted to be the first on the networks with a coast-to-coast amateur show. Fred didn't go so much for amateurs, but the agency wanted to do it. So he called me one day at WMCA and asked if I would like to work for him. I said, like to? I'd love it. I've been working for sharpshooters and this marathon racket and stuff, you know. So he says, well, when can you come over? I said, where are you living? He said, the Windsor Hotel. I says, 5 minutes after this broadcast is over, I'll be up your back like a mountain trout. And I was, too. And it was a handshake. And, of course, Bill Murray of the William Morris office got in and put a very good, you know, slug in there for me. And that was all I ever needed for 22 solid years.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. It is amazing. And looking at that Benny film there, Fred, he loved Benny. He really did. He stuck up for him in a lot of ways. Yeah, a lot of things that happened.
They really were good friends.
Oh, they were very dear pals.
But many people thought that feud was real.
Oh, I know they did. Golly, it was surprising how many people believed that thing. And one of the incidents that I thought was very good was Benny used to come east around Christmas time. He spent 4 or 5 weeks, and we'd swap guest stars. Benny on our show, Fred on his show, you know, Rochester, different ones. And this particular time, Benny didn't have his regular orchestra. He had Abe Lyman doing it here from the Vanderbilt Theater. And Abe started to kid him, and the show went on, and said, you better look out. He says, you're in Allen's territory, and be careful what you say. And Benny says, oh, yeah? Well, old Baggy Eyes better be on his good behavior, because One Punch Benny, you haven't heard about. He says, yeah, don't go fool around with that One Punch, because that's he says, yeah, wait till you see Benny the Champ, see? And they're talking about this, and about 10 minutes goes by, knock on the door, and Abe Lyman says, all right, Jack, One Punch, there's your man over there. Benny goes to the door, opens it, and says, well? Fred says, out of my way, Benny, or I'll knock you flattered in the first 8 minutes of your program. I want to tell you, Benny doubled up. He couldn't talk for a couple of minutes. He really and truly couldn't.
Jack does really appreciate
Oh, Jack,
humor,
yeah, Jack was great. And I'll tell you how grand he was, too. Fred didn't like to take telephone calls or rehearsal days or anything. This is out of school, this tale. But one day, Jack called up, and the feud was going great, you know. And he called up to say that two of his writers that did his end of the thing, you know, writing the answers, went down to Palm Springs. They weren't feeling good and so on, he was in a spot. And he wanted to ask Fred about it, and I got Fred out to talk to him. And Fred says, well, I can appreciate your spot, but tell you what you do. You call me tomorrow night about midnight. That'd be 9 o'clock your time. He says, and I'll write the spots for you. You know, have a secretary there, or a record or something, so he can take it down. And he wrote against himself for the next couple of shows. That's how much he liked Jay.
Yeah.
That plus all the writing he did on his own shows. You know, that. But he was so wonderful that way. You know,
I want to ask you a question about some lines that he threw at a dinner thrown for you. But we got to take time out now, Uncle Jim, for just a second. This is Today on NBC. was a dinner thrown for you, Uncle Jim, at one point. Do you remember much about what Fred...
He said a lot of nice things, of course. He did a little rundown on my life, which he knew very well. And I was going out then to take over Skelton. And every time Skelton would get in trouble, it'd be a call for Uncle Jim, and I'd fly out there, see? And I'd flown out and brought him into Chicago and St. Louis for a couple of dates, the old Metro and the Low House. And I sent him back. Then they had a little more trouble, and I had to go out there, see? So a lot of misguided friends gave me a dinner at the New York Athletic Club, see? And a few hundred people showed up, and Fred was the toastmaster. And he rarely ever did anything like that. Mm. He wouldn't take $5,000 from the sponsor to go over to the Astor Hotel and entertain their salesman. And he talked about me in my early days and how long we'd known each other. He talked about my wonderful wife, Marion. And he also gave me credit for things. He says, Jim is responsible. You're talking about that. I was on the Cardinals Lady Committee all these years. And he says, Jim is responsible for Horn and Hart. He tried to get Horn and Hart to put stained glass windows in the slots over there so the clergy would feel right at home. And incidentally, Jim, there was a water shortage at that time, and he says Jim caught the Cardinal out in back of the cathedral trying to change the wine back into water. He says, this is a farewell dinner to Jim, and when he gets to the coast, they're going to give him a farewell dinner as soon as he gets out there. You know, in other words, run your... And Fred had no habits, you know what I mean, like go to the track. Say, don't you go to the races, Fred? No, I don't see any sense to it. You don't? Horse racing? He says, no, I can't see. Oh, what's the matter? Well, he says... You go to the track, he says, the horse gets the exercise, the jockey goes for the ride, the bookmaker gets your money, and you're left holding the bag. You know,
something to that.
You know, he could boil a thing down, a situation, right into a few words. We were walking out of church one Sunday at St. Malachy's, and as we were walking down the street slowly and slowly, a midget went by us, and you know they walk very fast going down the street. As it went by, Fred looked at him and says, I guess he just came from the little church around the corner. You know, midget, little church, you know.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I miss on today's program with all of the guests that we have is Minerva Pius.
Oh, man. She was the best character woman on the air.
She did Mrs. Nussbaum, if you remember, in Allen's Alley. And one line that I'll never forget that sticks in my mind of all the Allen programs I listened to. She was telling about how unlucky her husband, Pierre was. She said that he was so unlucky that if it is raining borscht, he will be standing outside with a fork and missing the potato.
Well, you know, one night, to help an old friend out, we took Min up and put little Sam Hearn in. He used to do on the Benny Show, hello, stranger, Well, he'd been to Europe, come back, and things weren't so good, and I talked to Fred about it. Fred said, sure, let's put him in the alley. I'll pull Min out of there. So when he knocked on the door... says, Mrs. Nussbaum. He says, hello, stranger. He says, you're not. He says, no, I'm Pierre. Pansy went out shopping. You know, he called it Pansy Bear. And he played Pierre, the husband. And it worked out wonderfully, you know. Yeah. He could do it. The night we had Bose on the show, Bose didn't know about the midnight show and didn't show up. Harry Von Zelkerman says, Fred, what are we going to do? My God, that's a 9-minute spot. And Bose, you know, so.
The major Bose.
Yeah. And he says, well, what do you fellows always do? He said, Jim, I said, yeah, is you're going to be Major Bose by proxy on this next show. That's okay. When he's going to introduce, he says, he's ready to introduce Bose, you know, and Harry Bonzo says, but Freddie, he says, please, Harry, I'm introducing a great guest. He's the Harry. I'm speaking about a man whose name is a household word. He said, but that's it, Freddie. He's not here? No. Uncle Jim, yeah, you listened to the major, didn't you, at the early show? We did two shows then, you know. I said, yes. He says, well, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Major Bose by proxy in the person of Uncle Jim. And as soon as I said, round and round she goes, and where she stops, nobody, he says, oh.
Brian Keith and Nancy Malone star Thursday at 10, 9 Central Time.
We'll be strolling down Allen's Alley in just a moment. Right now it's 34 minutes after the hour, and I want to talk to you about something I've talked to you about before, but in case you haven't gotten in on it yet. Back in 1857... car. I'm sitting now beside my radio. That's a nice gift. It really is. At 36 minutes after the hour, this is our morning-long tribute to the beloved and well-remembered great man, Fred Allen. For most Allen fans, some of radio's greatest comic moments occurred in a mythical place called Allen's Alley, inhabited by some of the funniest characters in radio history. Jack Lasculli, standing in, not without great humility, for Fred Allen, goes for a stroll now down that alley that Fred and his wife, Portland, visited every Sunday night in radio's golden years.
Yes, it's time for a stroll down Allen's alley, and I think I'll knock at Senator Claghorn's door and find out how he spent his Thanksgiving.
Somebody, I say, somebody pummeled my watches.
Yes, sir.
Claghorn's a name, Senator Claghorn, that is.
Look,
Senator. Son, why don't you go away? Go button your nose. Go hem a hanky, son.
Well, I'm sorry, Senator, if you're busy. I just wanted to know, did you spend Thanksgiving with your family, Senator?
With my kin, son. What a day. My pappy goes out into the woods and kills a possum. Then he goes out in the barnyard and kills a turkey. Then pappy goes out to the still and kills 2 gallons.
You have a big dinner?
Son, when all the food's on, the 4 legs of the table is kneeling down.
I see. Now, what is Southern Thanksgiving dinner like?
Now we start with a Memphis martini.
A Memphis martini?
It's a tall glass of pure corn liquor with a wad of cotton in it. A boll weevil's riding the cotton. And then, after the drinks, comes Dixie canapés.
Dixie canapés?
That's a slew of porcupines running up and down the table. On the porcupine quills is stuck shrimps and cheese and sausage.
And after this?
Every guest is served a big shingle. On the shingle is a live catfish and a watermelon.
A live catfish?
Yeah, to kill the catfish, you drop the watermelon on it. And then comes alligator chowder, a whole alligator simmering in swamp water. Floating on top is mud balls for croutons.
I see. You have turkey?
Mock turkey, son. That's a jumbo raccoon stuffed with grits and magnolia bugs. For dessert, there's a heaping mound of mint sherbet nesting in a hog jowl. And when dinner's over, we all stand, raise our jugs, and give thanks.
Thanks? Thanks for what?
That we wasn't born in the North.
Well, the senator remains unreconstructed. I think I'll look in on Titus Moody.
Harry, Bob.
Good evening, Mr. Moody. You look depressed. What's wrong?
Oh, I'm thinking about psychiatry.
Well, tell me, Mr. Moody, what about this psychiatry business?
Well, I don't know how it works with humans, but I had a hen that had a nervous breakdown.
I see.
Yeah, she was having dizzy spells and falling off the nest. She was seeing spots for her eyes and trying to eat her astigmatism. Finally, her beak got soft. When she went to pick up something, well, her beak would bend.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Finish was, she had amnesia.
Your hen had amnesia?
She stopped laying eggs. She forgot what she was. She'd walk between the shafts of a wagon, waiting to be hitched.
Your hen thought she was a horse?
Well, one day. Next day, she'd be standing by the pail, waiting to be milked.
And you called the doctor?
Yeah, and he brought a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist says, Moody, your hen's got delusions. She's blacked out, he says. We got to bring her back, make her know she's a hen.
And what did the psychiatrist do?
Well, he was eating worms to remind her. He was jumping up and sitting on the nest. When he got off the nest, he pulled out a billiard ball and he showed the hen, you know, like he'd laid her egg. Well, the billiard ball done it. The hen's back now, laying an egg every day.
Fine.
But there's only one thing.
The billiard ball?
She won't lay her egg in the nest.
No?
No, the hen walks 3 miles down the road to the pool room. So long, Bub.
Well, Titus is like medicine. He's always being taken. Now, let's try this next door.
Who's talking?
Oh, how do you do? It's you. Tell me, Ajax, how do you feel about the discovery of gold?
Well, me boy, whenever I hear the word gold, I think of the sad case of Long Dan Dolan.
Now, what happened to Long Dan Dolan?
Well, you see, One year, Long Dan won the Irish sweepstakes. He took all the money, and he had gold teeth put in his head. Long Dan had so many gold teeth, he looked as though he just took a bite out of Fort Knox.
Uh-huh. His mouth was yellow, huh?
Yellow. When Long Dan smiled, it looked like a happy sunset.
Now, how was Long Dan's, or what was Long Dan's problem?
Oh, well, I'll tell you. When word circulated, you see, that Long Dan had won the sweepstakes, all his relatives started coming around to borrow money.
And Long Dan had all the money in gold teeth?
He did. But Long Dan was soft-hearted, you see. When a relative needed money for rent, Long Dan would have a gold tooth pulled and he'd pay the rent. Now, if another relative needed an operation, Long Dan would have a gold bicuspid pulled and pay for the operation. Long Dan had the teeth, but the relatives were putting the bite on him, you understand?
Now, how long did this continue?
Well, now, for about 2 years. Every other week, you'd see Long Dan coming out of the dentist's office handing a gold tooth to a crying relative.
And where is he now?
Nobody knows.
After having so many gold teeth pulled out, Long Dan disappeared completely?
Well, no, not completely. In Kerrigan's window, there's a life-sized oil painting of Long Dan Dolan. And he hasn't a tooth in his head.
But why is his picture in Kerrigan's window?
Long Dan Dolan is a man of extraction. Goodbye to you, boy.
Now, here's you.
Allen's Alley, and that was, if you didn't know the real names behind it, Peter Donald, who was just seen as Ajax Cassidy, Parker Finley, Titus Moody, and Kenny Delmar was the famous Senator Claghorn. We're going to come back to them and talk with them in just a moment and some others. Right now, here is Jack, who I suspect may introduce me. Jack.
Well, time just about 17 and a half before the hour. Life, care, and now we'll take a station break.
15 minutes before the hour. Now, Fred Allen was a celebrated letter writer, as you can see in a specimen you're about to see shows that he believed in narrow margins, and he also typed exclusively in lowercase. He used no capital letters. And his explanation for this was, I can't shift for myself. Now, the owner of the pastrami shrine referred to in the letter was Max Asnas, who heads the stage delicatessen, has for years here in New York. And Fred and his wife, Portland, were regulars there, good friends of Max. And Max is here in the studio with us now and is going to chat with Jack Lasculli. Jack?
Max, a pleasure to have you once again on today.
Well, nice to be here, Jack.
And I know you want to talk about your old friend, Fred Allen, but you have some letters that you brought in that Fred wrote to you. Yeah. And I'd like to know about those.
Well, whenever he used to go in Europe or anywhere I used to go, I used to write me letters, for instance, like he was in a place in Massachusetts, you know, in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts?
Yeah, and there's he saw a church, Saint Max. So he wrote me a letter, and the letter reads that I have had a church named after you.
A church named after you?
After me, yeah. And it says, and if I have a basket, I should come down and with my brother Jaime to walk around and make a collection, and then after the assignment, have a racetrack around.
Well, let me read
but
that.
He's funny. Yeah, you could read it better than I could,
I guess. You don't mind?
Yeah.
Dear Max, I have had a church named after you. If you want to take the place over, you can put a delicatessen counter in the basement and do plenty of business between the masses. You may have to go for a few stained glass windows for the church unless you want to use some of your windows, which are pretty well stained, as I recall. If you want to change this place over and operate it as a temple, I'm sure it can be arranged. These people want to sell, and if they are interested, I can get it for you cheap. You can preach the sermons, and the collections are all profit, no overhead, no effort. Just you and Jaime going down the aisle with a couple of big baskets. Let me know what you think. There is an atheist interested in the property. He wants to make a small trotting track in the back for ponies. Hope all goes well at the farm, regards Fred.
He always used to call a racetrack, he used to call a farm. And it happened he was in once with Portland and a friend of Portland's. And they were talking, and then she says, her friend says to me, Do you ever go for a vacation? I says, yes, I do go for a vacation. So Fred says he's got a farm in Long Island. And to her was a surprise that I should be a farmer. So she says, what do you raise on the farm? So he says, they plant money and they raise suckers. This is Belmont Park.
Belmont Park? This is another one. You
this is when he wrote the book. This, yeah, I wanted to put in a sign when he wrote the book, you know, in the window. So he gave me instructions how to...
Max, I don't know what sort of sign that you want to use. It seems to me that it might look funny if you had a simple sign reading, and then he's got this squared out like a sign. Yeah. One of my customers wrote a book. What could I do? Or, I recommend my food. P.S. Also this book, Max. You may have some other ideas, but the top sign, I think, explains everything and seems sort of funny. I'm sorry I wrote the bloody book. Regards, Fred Allen. That was,
He was a wonderful guy. He used to take small people and make them big. There's a lot of people in show business or in any other business that they look down on people. He never looked down on anybody. He always made them bigger. Mm-hmm. And he used to give a lot. I know one fellow, he used to go to jail on account of him because he used to get checks from him, $25 a week, you know. He used to send him every week a check, and the fellow used to cash it in my place. Before he used to cash the checks, I used to send him myself a few dollars, though. But he's a whiner. He's still in jail, though. But he must have a route or something. But Fred never turned on anybody. And he had a slow face, but a fast mind.
Max, and the program wouldn't have been complete without having a few opinions and some letters from Fred, and you especially in on the program. I want to thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Let's turn things over to you right now.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you, Max. What did you say? He had a slow face but a fast mind. I guess that's true. Peter Donald, the Parker Finley, and Kenny Delmar, also Uncle Jim Harkins, all worked with Fred Allen for years, and it's often been said that television never really used Fred Allen in the right way, and this there must be some truth in this. What do you think of this, gentlemen? We'll start with you, Peter. Because, you know, he made a couple of television attempts that didn't pan out.
Well, I know this is sort of the consensus of opinion with those of us who loved him here, that I think he was a little awed by it, or not so sure of how to handle it. Mm-hmm. So he let too many people tell him what to do, and they distorted his simplicity. Mm-hmm. And his characters. We did our Allen's Alley the first time with puppets, you know. This was in an attempt to make it visual, and it was forced.
Oh, it would have been better to do it just the way we did it here today,
yeah,
actually.
It didn't work out at all with puppets. Yeah. The timing was off, and we would rehearse the thing, over-rehearse it, which he never did. Fred never tried to give us any lines or tell us how to deliver the lines. Mm-hmm. You know, he depended on us to do it the way he thought we would.
Too many cooks in there spoiling the broth, then.
I think so.
You think if left to his own devices, he would have gone ahead in television very well. The same as Benny made the transition from radio to television.
Yeah, but you see, I think this, Hugh, when Jack went to television, he does most of it in the set of his home, you know. Mm-hmm. But we had the dancing girls and the trained ponies. We were trying to be the Sullivan Show at the same time. Yeah. It's all wrong.
After that, we did it for George Abbott. Remember that show? And that didn't come off well either, because Fred was always free to change and ad-lib at any point. And to be restricted and regimented wasn't comfortable for him.
Wouldn't have been. What was the last of the Allen radio shows? I'm trying to think what the date was. Was that going at the same time that he made the transition?
No.
It had gone...
It had gone off.
It had gone off. Radio finally got so it wouldn't sustain those high-budget programs anymore. It was shaking down, I guess, at that time.
That was Stop the Music that stopped us.
Stop the Music.
Was it really?
Yeah, sure.
I had an announcement where I offered $50,000, and it was guaranteed by Lloyd's, I think, Lloyd's of London, that if anyone were to have been called while we were on the air so that they would have avoided listening to Stop the Music, we would pay them the $50,000, because it was determined that the calls were pre-programmed. In other words, the people had been called that afternoon, not during the course of the show, you see. And that helped for a while, didn't it?
But what was the last of the radio shows? Do you remember the date? Or what year that was?
49 or 50, wasn't it? 49.
Or was it around in that...
Uncle Jim, was that...
49.
49, yeah. Uh-huh. At the end of the season.
Hey, Uncle Jim, you still got your microphone?
He doesn't need one. You can hear him all the way to the Friars.
Come on over. You can share mine. Funny thing is...
I got to do everything.
Yeah.
Good morning. Uncle Jim's been with us throughout this time because he is, of course, one who, our guest today, who knew Fred Allen dating back to the very earliest. When did the Allen radio program go on the air in the form that we knew it? Now, I don't know when you gentlemen joined, but do you know when the start of it was?
1932.
In 1932.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about that, Jim, that it was called the Linnet Bath Club.
That's
on
right.
For corn products.
Yeah.
And it was over at the other network, and I'm that old-fashioned that I don't mention.
Oh, that's
on
very nice of you.
Now. Yes. And Fred was in Studio 3, and I was on for the same client with a kid show for some dessert in the adjoining studio. And we were there exactly the same time, and yet we never met until years later, around 1945.
Well, Jim knows who the people were involved, but Fred told once that... he was fired by some client because he wasn't funny, and they got Ed Sullivan.
Well, I don't know. Do you remember? Finished?
Well, no, not finished. Yeah. There's one thing I wanted to get to, and the one thing that Fred Allen did he did well, even though it was at a time that television didn't use this technique often, and that was the narration of films. And Fred did a good job in narrating. How good would he be in the television documentary field could be estimated by a sampling of this excerpt, which is completed the year before his death, from the Jazz Age. That was an NBC Project 20 special about the Roaring Twenties. And in this excerpt, we pick up Fred as he's discussing royalty and the American migration to Paris. Listen.
King George wisely stays home, but his son and heir, David, Prince of Wales, and England's most popular export, ignores the threats of Big Bill Thompson and sweeps America off its feet. Every debutante's mother holds these truths to be self-evident. All men may be created equal, but for a son-in-law, give me a prince any day in the week. Americans can take their choice, a prince or a queen. Royalty becomes as popular as Mahjong and crossword puzzles. Queen Marie of Romania, sniffing the prophets of ballyhoo from the faraway Balkans, arrives on the Leviathan for a command performance, complete with press agent, business manager, and a contract with a newspaper syndicate. But I'll tell the cockeyed world one thing this royalty has, that's charm and plenty of it. So much, in fact, that after the gal saw the Prince of Wales, they knew who had stolen their hearts away. And Queen Marie has the same effect on the boys. Who makes me dream all day? Well, you ought to guess who? No one but you. As Her Highness heads for Park Avenue and Main Street, she will miss thousands of Americans who are turning the tables on Columbus and discovering Europe. There's one foreign entanglement that nobody who can afford it objects to, an entanglement with France, which usually means Paris, and more people can afford it than ever before. The great rush of innocence abroad is on, so it's pack up all my cares and woe, here I go, singing low, bye-bye Blackbird.
Fred Allen, that was the only time that we heard his voice in the time that we've been doing this two-hour salute to the great comedian and wit who died 8 years ago yesterday as you're watching this. Yeah, Jack's memories of, he was just saying that he could talk about Fred probably for 5 or 6 hours here and not run out of things.
Well, Fred took a liking to me when I first came to New York. He had known that I was in radio and had done a show on the coast called Grouch Club, which he used to listen to. And, of course, invited me backstage, and I did some work with him, although I didn't work the actual program. But I did know Uncle Jim and became acquainted with him. And every week, we'd go backstage and sit around with Fred. To sit around with Fred and listen to him talk about any subject at all was always fascinating. He had a picturesque way and a way of looking and slanting at something. His description of Portland's family and how the girls were named, and Portland's father, who was a kind of a dentist, sort of a medicine man, actually. Yeah. He used to hold forth on this.
What were the places where he held forth, besides Max's?
Usually his home or Max's. He would go into Max's after the show. You might catch him at breakfast over at a little coffee shop on 7th Avenue when he'd come from Mass at St. Patrick's.
But he lived right in Manhattan, too.
Yes, oh yes, he lived right up here on 57th Street, just off 57th.
It's been most worthwhile, I think, to reminisce with these people. I want to thank the ones who are here today. Kenny Delmar, Peter Donald, Parker Fenley, and Uncle Jim Harkins for being with us on this two-hour salute to Fred Allen. Thank you, Jack. I'll see you tomorrow.
Indeed.
Our time's up now, and we'll take a station break.
Johnny Dollar.
Hi, kiddo. Carter at Universal Adjustment.
Jim, how are you?
In a rush. I have to catch a plane to Tucson, Arizona.
Lucky you. Nice there this time of year.
No, listen. One of our brokers out there wrote a 50,000 straight life policy on a man named James Lansing. Lansing dropped dead 2 days ago.
Uh-huh.
And you'll never guess why.
I'll bite. Why?
Mr. Lansing starved